Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lambert and I today is pension specialist Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, what to do with a life-changing windfall. Simon has some suggestions that don't all involve sending cheques to editor at thisismoney.co.uk. Tanya is here to tell you the secret to boosting your retirement funds. We have an update on electric cars that you might not like. The new Visa mobile verification, a nightmare or dream for online shoppers. And This Is Money have lifted the lid on a scandal that could see grieving families hit for thousands of pounds. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, when we speak about getting a financial windfall, it always seems to be off the back of something, well, bad. A divorce, redundancy, inheritance. But this week, thankfully, you've actually got something a little bit more positive. One of your readers, Simon, got in touch wanting a bit of advice. Now, they'd worked hard building their business and had just sold it for over £1 million. Well done them. Now, while they had a few ideas about what they wanted to do with part of the cash, they called on Simon and the team to help out with the rest. But even if you don't have £1 million company to sell, there will be many, many people who'll get windfalls in other ways. And no, they don't all have to be bad. You can get a small lottery win if you're so lucky, and they will be pondering similar questions. So what do you need to be thinking about and what are your options? So for Simon, first of all, let's talk about the reader that got in contact with you. What was their situation? What were they wanting to know?
Okay, so here you go. I'm just going to read this. I have spent the last 30 years building up a manufacturing business, and at the age of 50 I've decided to sell up and spend more time enjoying life. I'm selling the business for £1.2 million after tax and plan to set aside £400,000 for spending over the next decade. I want to protect the remaining £800,000 as much as possible while also hoping to see it grow by inflation plus a bit. My wife and I plan to do some travelling around the world for extended trips. I'll do some consultancy work in between these to deliver an annual income for us. I plan to use the £400,000 cash set aside from the sale to supplement this annual income until I start drawing on my pension in 10 years' time when I turn 60. My pension pot is currently worth £600,000. We own our home and have paid off the mortgage. I've previously invested my money and managed my own pension, but I don't really want to invest the money from the business sale myself. However, I do want to know where it's being invested and why. What are my options and how could I protect the money but get growth of inflation plus a few percent? Now, that is the nub of the question, really, isn't it? What are my options? How do I spend some of it? How do I invest some of it? And ignoring the bit that I've decided to spend, because I've already set that to one side and gone, right, that's my spending money. How do I invest the rest, crucially to protect it, but also get a reasonable rate of growth so it doesn't get eaten away by inflation? Because, of course, you could just split it amongst a load of savings accounts and then you'll know that it's protected by the FSCS Financial Services Compensation Scheme up to £85,000 per account. Mm-hmm. But you're probably going to lose money on inflation. And realistically, you want to be getting a better return from that. This is from a new section we've started up called Wealth Check, which is basically aimed at dealing with people who end up with what would be described as large sums of money to invest, or perhaps life-changing sums of money to deal with. And what do you do with it? This kind of scenario is rare, right, to have a large sum of money. But there are more people finding themselves in this position. And there's going to be, you know, lots more people who find themselves in this position due to things like massive house price growth, people selling up after, you know, running businesses for years and years and years. And also, actually, interestingly, there's a phenomenon where it's pretty rare, but there are a sizable chunk of people in their 30s and 40s finding themselves in this kind of position, largely who've done things like set up successful businesses with some form of tech bent to them over the past 5 years, and may have found themselves getting bought out, or worked in the financial services industry and have found themselves getting bought out. And they can end up with, you know, a couple of £1 million at a relatively young age. Now, having lots of money is a nice problem, but working out what you do with it so you don't squander it is still a problem nonetheless. So what are you going to do? I mean, firstly, I think it's very sensible, if you've got a large sum, to think about splitting it. So it's the, if you don't want to just keep working, if you do want to take a step back, enjoy life, do a little bit of work on the side to get some money coming in, but you need to supplement that. Put some money aside, you know, and say, right, I'm putting that in cash. I'm just going to spend that. I'm not going to worry about investing it. And then with the rest of it, when you invest it, you need to think about those things that we talked about before. You need to think about how much you need or want to protect it, i.e. how much of a issue would it be for you financially and mentally if one day it was down 30% because the stock market took a tumble? What kind of returns that you want to get? Are you happy with inflation? Are you happy with inflation plus a little bit? What kind of returns could you get? And then you start thinking about where you invest it and whether you do that yourself or whether you get a professional to help you, such as a financial advisor or perhaps a wealth manager. And I'd say if you were in this kind of position, seeing a financial advisor would probably be a very good idea.
All right, to This Is Money, but I'd go for the financial advisor as
well.
Yeah,
I mean, we're not providing advice here. We're just basically giving some pointers and saying, look, these are the kind of things you could be thinking about. Just to put it into context, if you had £1.2 million and you set aside £400,000 to spend and you invested £800,000, in this case, with someone who's 50 looking at, then, you know, for 10 years.
Because age matters,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, because age matters.
Yeah.
Well, if you could achieve a 5% investment return after fees, which is not impossible, well, it's good, but it's not impossible, and it's not overly ambitious, with £800,000 over 10 years, it would grow to £1.32 million, which would more than offset the £400,000 you'd spent. It's important to note a couple of things, though. One, that rate of return isn't by no means guaranteed. Yeah. And two, that inflation will erode the value of money. So really, it's probably worth less than the £400,000 in the first place. And then also that for someone in this position, when they hit 60, they might be able to use their private pension, but they're not going to get their state pension until they're 67. So we asked Seven Investment Management for some information around kind of expected returns and also the kind of things people think about when they're investing money like this. Sophie Kilvert there came back with an answer for us. She said that the most cautious risk profile would probably only produce a long-term return of around 3% a year after fees. So you're only just going to be beating inflation. The next level up of risk would return about 4% after fees. And then if you went for the balanced profile, two steps up the ladder, that should achieve a return of about 5 to 6% a year after fees over the long term. Although she said, bearing in mind, there are no guarantees. Now, that's interesting because what she said often happens is when clients come to them, they say, yeah, I'm cautious. I need to, you know, cautious, absolutely maximum caution kind of thing. But then when you speak to them and you say to them, how cautious are you? And they'll be very cautious. I don't want to lose any of it. Don't want to risk any of it kind of thing. But then it's like, well, what are you going to do with this money? Do you need it for an emergency? No. Do you plan to spend it in the short term? No. What do you plan on doing it? I just want to keep it there. I want to keep it growing. Maybe someday I'll pass it on to the kids or something like that. And actually, you find that they've actually got quite a long-term investing horizon. And as long as they can deal with the investing behavioural problems that might come with seeing their money down 20% one day because the stock market's fallen, they can afford to be taking a bit more risk because they're going to get better returns for it. And in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, they'll probably be better off than if they'd have gone with the very cautious option.
Tanya, I want to bring you in here because maybe you don't have a business that you've sold for £1.2 million. Maybe you're not a 30-year-old tech-savvy young millennial who's just got himself a couple of million quid. A lot of people will be getting figures through, like I said a little bit earlier, divorce, redundancy, inheritance, that could be life-changing in as much as you could get a house for it or any sort of thing. So what are the sort of issues that you should be thinking about, I suppose, at different ages? You know, putting money into a pension, should you, I suppose, if you want a house, that might be a priority, paying off debts. What sort of things should you be thinking about? What sort of ages?
Well, I think at 50, which is what this guy was retiring at, you've got to remember that is, you might still live a really long time, or your wife might, and if you're going to look after her as well, you might well live until you're 90.
Or your
husband. Yes. Yeah. So therefore, although the expert concentrated on the balanced and the cautious area, it is worth thinking about putting some in growth as well. Because if you're thinking about maybe 90 or my wife 90, 40 years is a long time. Most people's working life is 40 years. So it could be your whole working life again.
That puts it into perspective, doesn't it? Goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also one of the things people reading this will think about is, could I retire on that? How much would I need to actually retire, to stop work tomorrow? And I think an awful lot depends on how much you're going to spend. I could easily retire on 1.2 million tomorrow because
could you, Simon?
It would depend on my lifestyle.
1.2 million, could you retire on that?
Yeah, I could retire on 1.2 million. I'd probably end up doing a bit of work. You could get a very nice lifestyle out of £1.2 million. There is one crucial element there, though, is you probably need to own your own home and have paid down a reasonable amount of it, or not want to live in a particularly big or expensive house in certain parts of the country. Otherwise, you could burn through £1.2 million very quickly. Because I could buy a house for £1.2 million like that, and it wouldn't even be that big or that fancy. It would just be in a certain part of the country.
Yeah, so I think when people are approaching this, they need to think carefully about the lifestyle that they want. My lifestyle would fit very comfortably into £1.2 million. But if, this guy talked about going on cruises. Now, if he wants to spend half his year on around the world cruise, then that is going to eat up a lot of money, and then you have to be maybe a bit more aggressive on the investments. But if you plan to sort of take short breaks around the UK and maybe in Europe with your retirement, then you'd be absolutely fine. So I think people need to really consider what they plan to do with their retirement when they're working out how to do it.
Well, that's interesting, because you've got some research from Hargreaves Lansdown, because selling your business, that may not be the secret to an early retirement for everyone, because not everyone might have a £1 million business to sell. But Hargreaves Lansdown say the secret is getting a bit more hands-on now. Now, they reckon ditching the one-size-fits-all pension fund chosen by your employer and proactively picking your own investments might be the way to go. Brilliant! But it sounds really scary. How likely are we to do this? What are they actually suggesting here?
People get defaulted into a pension fund when they sign up on their work scheme. And most people stay in it. 90% of us stay in the default fund. Hargreaves had a slightly higher figure. They reckoned that 22% would go outside the default fund. So close on 80% would stay in the default. But that's, I asked them about the kind of savers they have in their schemes, and they're professionals, they're financial services company, they're lawyers, they're people in the tech industry. So it might be skewed higher for that reason. But most of us stay in our default fund. But most modern pension schemes will give you a range of funds, maybe 10 or 12, depending on how your employer has set up your scheme. And you can invest in those pension funds rather than be in the default one. The default one is usually set up to be as safe and as broad as possible. The charges are usually really cheap, so that is an advantage. They're often trackers. So therefore, if you decide to go in one of these other funds, they're often actively run, so more expensive, which you have to factor in. But these are run by professional stock pickers who are trying to beat the market. And the Hargreaves research has compared a basket of default funds from all the big providers against the most popular actively run funds that their savers in their work schemes tend to pick. So they created a list of the top 10 that these particular savers will go for, and they've compared them. They've found that you do a lot better. Over 5 years, the basket of default funds, you might make 8% over 5 years, but you might get a return of 12.74%, they worked out, from these top 10 very popular investment funds that are actively run. So that's a really sizable difference, a really sizable difference.
Well, give it to us in money terms. Materialistic, what are we talking about when it comes to retirement? What's the difference?
They gave an example of what 1% extra growth on your pension would actually get you. Say somebody who was 22 and was going to retire at 68 on the median UK salary of 28,000, putting 8% of their salary away, they would get an investment return of 5% net of fees. Now, they worked out that someone in that position who was in the default fund, the classic default fund, would end up with a pot of 191,000, which sounds quite nice, but just 1% extra growth on that would be 250,000.
Okay, yeah.
So that is a really sizable jump. And obviously they're talking about getting the difference between 8% and 12.74%. So that's a lot more than 1% in terms of the difference. So their figures do suggest that you could do a lot better.
I will ask, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, it depends on where you stand with actively managed funds. Professional stock pickers will try and beat the market, but they will charge for it. And trackers will match what the market does, whether it goes up or down, but they are incredibly cheap in comparison. And so you have to look at the funds that are available to you. Most people will have, I think in our one, we've got about 10 or 12 options. Mm. So you need to research them and try and work out if you think that they're going to do so much better than the default fund that it's worth taking that extra risk. Now, you are going to be investing over a long time. If you've got decades to play with, then it may well be that that is very much worth your while. But you do need to be prepared to do the research on the funds in your own scheme and work out if you think they're going to be any better.
And therein, Simon, lies the rub. One, you have to do a lot of research, which lots of people don't really want to do. But also, if you do the research, how easy is it to compare like for like?
That all depends on your company's pension scheme and where it is invested. Now, the first piece of research that you need to do is into how good your default fund is, because you don't know if it's worth switching away from it unless you know what it actually is and what's in it. So what does it invest in? What does this default fund do? And what does it cost? Now, you might find, and you're highly likely to find, that your default fund is some form of tracker fund, something that just follows the stock market. Now, if it's a global tracker fund that just invests in the world stock market, and it's got a low cost, which can be, you know, very, very cheap, then you might think it's just worth staying in that, because the idea there is that you are investing in companies' power to make profits over the long term, to take money, put it to productive use, turn a profit from it. The companies that do that do well and they get bigger, and the companies that do that and do badly drop out of the equation, and you're investing around the world. And by not trying to pick the winners, you don't run the risk of choosing the losers. So if you think, well, you know what, that sounds all right for me, you could just stick with the default. If you decide not to stick with the default fund, then you've got to think about where else are you going to invest. And that's where we come back to your question of, like, what funds do you choose? Well, ideally, you want to be choosing some funds that have got a fund manager who has got a track record of consistently beating the market or outperforming, who has outlined in simple and easy to understand terms exactly what their investing style and outlook is and how they do it and why they do it. You might want to look at what they're actually investing in. Does that fit with what they're saying? Does that fit with the kind of thing that you want to invest in? Does it fit with the kind of thing that you think might do well in the world?
Are these things easy to find out?
No, you need to do a bit of research. But, right. You know, I mean, so how long do people spend on social media every day? Probably about half an hour doing some panic scrolling if they're fairly light social media users. Maybe up to 2 hours just panic scrolling through Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, etc. If they're heavy users, panic scrolling. You know when you get your phone out, you're just like thumbing down it and then thumbing back up and thumbing
just
down.
Like, what are you panic scrolling
for?
Yeah,
that's like, a panic scroll.
Must see what everybody's doing.
Yeah, it's the mobile phone and iPad has delivered a certain type of internet behaviour,
right,
which
okay.
involves not really looking at anything, but just like whizzing up and down feeds. However, you probably spend a bit of time a week on it. Maybe you could just allocate a little bit of that time each week to investigating your pension and what's in it and whether there should be something better in it, because maybe that might pay off to a greater degree when you hit the age of 65 than panic scrolling through Instagram.
What a great piece of advice. No, what a great... When you think about it like that. Yeah,
yeah, well, look, people say I don't have time to sort out my finances.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, just don't allocate all the time you spend on social media. You know, don't do that. You're going to miss the gram. But just basically spend half an hour that you would otherwise spend looking through social media whilst also watching the television at the same time.
Yeah.
So you're not paying any attention to either of the damn things.
Yeah.
Just take that half an hour and go sit in a room without your phone and have a look at your pension or your ISA or whatever. But anyway, where are you going to invest? Well, you need to look into this. So most companies have recommended fund lists. Those are a reasonable place to start because actually they do put some proper research into this. The problem is that most people, when they choose different funds, are going to go on past performance, what has done really well over the last 5 years. And actually the harder thing is working out what's going to do well over the next 5 years. Because firstly, 5 years isn't long enough to prove that a manager actually has any skill in beating the market. Secondly, what happened over the last 5 years might not happen again over the next 5 years. The conditions over the last 5 years that made that fund do well might not be the conditions over the next 5 years. So you need to think about, what do I think is going to happen to the world in the future, not what just happened to the world in the past. And getting that kind of crystal ball out can be very difficult. And the thing about people picking these winning funds rather than the default and then them doing much better and getting better performance is a bit of a virtuous circle, because what they're doing is they're looking at the stuff that's done well, and then they're buying it themselves, and then there's these figures showing, well, look, these people who have moved out of the default fund have bought these things, and they've done really well over the last 5 years, and that's great until the circle gets broken and it stops, and then things fall. So actually, one of the things that you might want to do, you could do 50% in the default fund and 50% in ones you chose yourself. You could do 70% in the default fund and 30% the other way. You could do 90 and 10. It doesn't have to be an all or nothing.
Is that depends on what your workplace allows? Or
because essentially your workplace, if it is allowing you to choose funds, will allow you to choose from a selection of funds, and you can put 50% into the default one. That's your choice. And you could put the other 50% into five different funds that invest in different things. And then you can keep an eye on it, maybe take half hour watching Love Island in a year's time and work out which did better. And then you can see whether you want to continue with that or go back to having 100% of the default.
Well, I did this a few years ago because I wrote a guide to how to tell if your pension is invested in a Duff fund. Diversity, cost, risk, performance, turnover, that's how often they trade because that costs you more, and objective. So that's a six-step checklist, which is a sort of summary of what Simon's already said. And so I looked at all the funds, and having gone through them, I just couldn't decide. I just couldn't work out whether any of them would do any better, taking into account the fees, than the default fund. So I stuck with the default fund, having done all the research.
Yeah, and actually, in some cases, that will be the case, that it may not do better. But doing your research is, as Simon pointed out, not a bad place to be, right?
Having written the guide, I felt I had to do it.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, well, earlier we spoke about inheritance, but it turns out even if you have a will in place, your family, rather than benefiting, could actually be left tens of thousands of pounds out of pocket. Now, this is money you've revealed. Up to 1.5 million of us have been sold rip-off wills by banks. Some include such onerous T's and C's, who'd have thought? The grieving families could incur huge charges they knew nothing about. So, Simon, tell us more.
Okay, well, the issue here is that when you write a will, there are a number of things that you need to do. And one of those things is naming your executor. Your executor is the person who pulls it all together after you die. They are responsible for making sure that the will is enacted in terms of where your money goes. But that also means that they need to work out how much you were worth, where all your money is, get all that money together, pass it on to the people you've left it to. Perhaps they need to sell the property and things like that. So it's a decent sized job. And that's why if you decide to name someone as an executor, it's always a good idea to ask them first. But it is something that actually many people, if they can think of someone who would do it for them and they ask them to do it, quite often people will go, yes, actually, I would do that for you, kind of thing. Now, what happens in some cases when you go and get your will written is the person who is writing your will, the company, the bank, the solicitor, says, oh, well, we'll act as your executor. I mean, they might tell you this in a very explicit sense, or they might just quickly gloss over it.
Okay.
And then your family, or whoever else, after you die, finds out that the charge for them being the executor is pretty hefty, because a lot of them have percentage-based charges written in. Now, the thing that has driven up the cost of those charges is not actually something that means that it's any more expensive to act as the executor. And it's the fact that people are leaving properties to people in their will. And because house prices are very high and properties are expensive, that property that might have only been worth £80,000 when you made your will might now be worth a couple of £100,000. And all of a sudden, that percentage-based charge has absolutely rocketed. So what this was a story from our sister publication, Money Mail, where they had a series of people who had come forward and said, yes, this happened to us, to our family. So what you need to do if you get someone to write a will for you is be very careful about who's being appointed executor. And if you are appointing that solicitor or that bank as an executor, if you do agree to it, agree some form of flat fee that doesn't change, or something that is a fair percentage fee, or a percentage fee that has a limit to how high it goes. And if they won't agree to that, don't get them to write your will.
Is there any sniff of mis-selling here, or is it just...
Well, I find this absolutely shocking. It's like a poison pill that they put in these wills that people are only going to find out decades later, yeah. and not you, but your children.
Mm.
You have to wonder what they were thinking when they were doing this. I don't know about mis-selling. It probably is all fine and legal. I think that we're so tired of being shocked at what the banks have done that we've used it all up. But really, the fact that they were working out how to put massive fees on people
yeah.
years down the line for what seemed like a very cheap and simple will option. I mean, if only they'd been taking a bit more care of their own money and not crashing the world economy instead of creating these terrible terms and conditions for people who I don't know if it was mis-selling or not, but it's yet another
Certainly
thing
not
that makes me very angry
morally
about the banks.
All right, well, OK, let's move on from that, because last week we covered the government's new plan to get drivers to go green. And one of the ideas I was most keen on, for anyone who's a bit unsure about electric, you just want to dip your toe in the water. Don't dip your toe in the water with anything electric, though. Can I just point that out? But you could buy a used car. Now, Simon, you told me of some pretty tempting prices, but I've been reading an article by your motoring correspondent, Rob Hull, that the price of used cars, electric used cars, I should say, is on the up, somewhere 30% more than a year ago. Now, is this because everybody was listening to the show and went out and bought a load of electric? No, it's probably not. But what is the reason for this?
The reason for this is the crackdown on petrol and diesel cars, the knowledge that more people who are driving older petrol and diesel cars are going to start getting charged for driving into city centres. London's ULEZ will come in, £12.50 a day, and that will hit petrol cars that are older than 2006 and diesel cars that are older than 2015. So that's a lot of fairly modern cars. And this is going to happen to cities around the UK. And people are also thinking to themselves, well, maybe there's something to this electric car kind of thing. There are more charging points, they're getting easier to use. Perhaps if I only use my car for driving into town, dropping the kids off for school, doing the shopping, short distances, maybe a cheap little electric runaround might be the answer and it might save me some money. Also, they might be thinking, yeah, I'll keep the normal big family car for the long trips and I'll do that. So if you look down the list of cars that are going up in price, there are a selection of smaller and cheaper electric cars, so we're not talking big, expensive Teslas here, that have been going up in value because more people are chasing after them. And normally, if you want to buy a car that will rise in value, you need to go for something classic or exotic, not a £6,000 little runaround hatchback. But the Renault Zoe, the cost of one is up 30%
Goodness.
Over the past year. But amazingly, if you had bought a Renault Zoe, the average price, according to HPI, would have been £6,300 a year ago. And then you'd driven it for an entire year, doing 12,000 miles, which you're very unlikely to have done in a small electric car. But if you'd done 12,000 miles in it, it would now be worth £8,150 on average. So up 30%, even though you've been driving it. There's not many classic cars that are up by that much. The only thing I would say is we were talking about electric car prices, used electric car prices on the show the other day. So HPI have said these are the average price. You can get a Renault Zoe for much cheaper than that. You can pick up a Renault Zoe for about £5,000 or £6,000 now. And there is another caveat. This is possibly not likely to continue. I wouldn't just like stick your pension in a Renault Zoe because it's going to go up 30% every year.
Yeah, probably not. Right, well, two-step verification comes to online shopping. So those buying stuff online via their credit or debit card will soon have to enter a one-time passcode sent directly to their mobile phone via text message to complete certain orders. Now, it will replace the current system where you have to enter characters from a verified by Visa password. Now, a terrible annoyance, particularly for those with rubbish mobile phone receptions or who just don't trust text messages, or a brilliant bit of extra friction to make you think twice before you splurge. Tanya, just explain, because this two-step verification thing, we're seeing a lot more, aren't we? We're seeing it with banks, online shopping. I think things like Facebook and social media, you're getting it. What exactly is it?
if you have if you do it at the moment in most places, they will ask you for a password that you have created at some point along the line. And after you've gone through the first layer of a transaction, message will pop up and say you now need to put your password in for this particular credit card, which is a bit of a pain because I can never remember what it is. I usually have to click the button to say I've forgotten my password, get it sent to me again and go from scratch, which all creates a lot of extra time. What they're talking about now is making this even more difficult by you having to wait for a text message and then inputting that. So it is an extra lot of hassle. And
or layer of security, one might call it, rather than just a no, you're not a fan?
Yeah, yes, I guess, but I think that it will create more opportunities for fraud. And we're so worried about all these text messages getting spoofed. They're so sophisticated that they can pop up in the timeline of your bank's text messages to you. How do you know that the message that pops up is actually from your bank and not from a fraudster when it appears in the same timeline? This is the kind of thing that has caused loads of headaches for people when they're trying to do transfers, who have been defrauded of lots of money as a result. It just sounds like it's extra hassle and it creates extra opportunities for fraudsters. You also have to think about Wi-Fi hotspots. It depends where you do it. Perhaps if you do it in your own house, even then maybe you couldn't be absolutely certain that someone isn't parked outside your house in a really extreme circumstances. But certainly if you used public Wi-Fi to do a transaction, how do you know your details aren't being misused?
So I come at this perhaps a little bit more comfortable because I'm used to this in quite a few areas. Why I like it is because I do think, one, taking a little bit more time before you, particularly with things like clothing and those sorts of things, you know, if you're trying to budget, it's difficult when it's just so easy to just click a few buttons and boom, I'm going to get that dress through the post or whatever it is you're buying. And so this little bit of extra friction to make you think twice before you splurge out is, for me, not that I think I'm particularly one to do a lot of online shopping, but I just think, from a lot of friends who've said this, might be a good thing, Simon?
I guess so, but you've kind of already made the purchase by the time this comes up. And also, it doesn't come up every time you make a purchase.
Well, if you don't press the right code, you haven't paid the price.
Well, actually, there's an interesting thing there. This doesn't come up for every transaction. The banks make the decision as to what level of sort of security they want and how they want to do this. Mm-hmm. And Visa is essentially, because Visa processes the transactions, Visa enacts it for them. This is the solution that Visa has come up with. But if you think about the Verify by Visa scheme, it doesn't come up every time you buy something. It only comes up every so often. And sometimes it comes up on the screen and then you don't even have to put in your password. And then it vanishes away. So what lies behind this is that is basically the transaction being processed and your bank going, oh, no, it's okay, we don't need you to put in a password because this looks like the kind of transaction you might make. This is a company that you buy things off regularly. The things like that. Whereas if they think, oh, hang on a minute, we might need an extra level of security there, new company, you've never bought something from before, this is an unusual transaction, this is for a lot of money, then it pops up. So you're not going to get this on your mobile phone every time you make a transaction, which is what we thought initially. That would have driven you absolutely bonkers.
Yes.
But you are going to get it more possibly than you get the Verified by Visa at the moment. And we had someone explaining to us, not from Visa, but the other day, talking to Lee, who's going to do a follow-up story on this, but it might be as much as 1 in 4 times that you purchase something online. So that would be quite annoying, because what if you don't have your phone on you? But yes, I suppose you're right. An extra little bit of friction in between that would help. I mean, maybe banks could come up with a system that you could sign up to, you could opt into, where it flashes up a message before, instead of after you've made the purchase, but before you've made the purchase.
Are you sure about
this? That says, do you really need this?
Take 5 minutes out.
Do you really want this?
Have a really good think about it. It's interesting you talked about the Verified by Visa, because I used to get it every single time. And it's only now that you've mentioned it, I haven't noticed it in a while, except the box will pop up a couple of times. I've seen that and then it just disappears.
Yes, and also what you need to do as well is, you know, when that Verified by Visa comes up and then you put in your password, so it doesn't instantly vanish, or you put in your password, or it says, yes, this has been done, you know, this has been processed, and then it sort of sits there for a minute on that screen, and then it moves on to the next screen. The temptation is, when it sat there for a minute on that screen, certainly on my behalf, is to go, right, done, I've bought this, just hit the little X at the top of the internet window, close it down, and then the thing never arrives, or there's something never happens. And I finally worked this out a while back, which is, unless you wait for it to tick through and land on the next screen, you're actually, by cancelling the Verify by Visa window, you're essentially cancelling the transaction, and the transaction doesn't go through.
You're obviously very savvy, and you don't give them your email or log in to wherever it is you're buying clothes or beauty products or whatever from, because they'll get an email going, did you realise you left this in your basket? Do you want to buy it again? No, no, leave me alone. There is obviously an issue with fraud. So what is the answer if this is not the answer? Because you have to marry that up, don't you? That inconvenience. I can never remember my passwords for anything.
No,
it drives me crazy.
And I don't trust a password manager because they're the obvious things that are going to get hacked. So if I entrust all my passwords to one site, that's just easy prey, isn't it? So I don't know. I suppose what I do is I try and remember them. I try and remember all the main ones. It makes me concentrate on a few selected sites that I use again and again, so I'm going to remember my password. Or I'm just constantly saying I've forgotten my password and getting it sent and setting up a new one, which I'm even less likely to remember because I'm on my third one with the same site.
Simon, what's the answer?
Maybe the answer is making the actual card transaction a little bit more secure. So at the moment, what do? You fill in your card number, put in your name and your address and everything. You fill in your card number, the expiry date, and the three-digit called a security code sometimes, isn't it, off the back. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly secure, it's three numbers on the back of your card.
Yeah.
Now, that's the same every time, and the risk is that someone manages to intercept your details, and if they've got those details and there's no other check, then they can get it through. Maybe instead of doing the three-digit code on the back, they introduce a system whereby you set a number, and a long number, so not a four-digit number, but something like as long as a phone number. And everyone can remember a phone number, right? Pretty much. You can remember a phone number. It could be shorter than a phone number. It could just be eight digits. And then they ask you at that point for three of those, but it's a different three each time, like you get when you log into internet banking, or how the Verify by Visa thing does it at the moment. And all you got to do is therefore remember eight numbers or ten numbers and get number 2, 6, and 9 this time round. And so actually, maybe if you made that bit more secure, you wouldn't need to add an extra level on top of it.
There you go. Visa, are you listening? Verified by Simon. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.